Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
The NCAA, the powerful college sports association, is following in the footsteps of the NBA, announcing its moving championships scheduled in North Carolina because of that state's controversial law, House Bill 2, also known as the Bathroom Bill. It requires that anyone using restrooms in public buildings like sporting arenas must use the one that corresponds with the gender on their birth certificates, a requirement the transgender community says forces them into restrooms with the wrong gender. And in support, in July, the NBA pulled the 2017 All-Star Game from that state. Jeff DeBeery is Capital Bureau Chief for Here and Now contributor WUNC. So, Jeff, what NCAA events are we talking about?
As you mentioned, basketball is the big one for 2017, set to take place in Greensboro. There are also championship events that have been moved. These include women's soccer, men's and women's soccer championships, baseball, golf, lacrosse. So a series of sports, basketball being the most lucrative and well-known of those.
So the NBA, the NCAA, double blow to North Carolina's culture. You spoke with Henry Fourier, president of Greensboro Sports Commission Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. Here's a little of what he had to say.
Kick in the gut. Think we all knew this was coming, but somehow I found myself in denial and hopeful that it wasn't going to happen.
How much money are we talking about, Jeff?
Specific to basketball, Robin, we're talking about $14.5 million. That's what the estimated economic impact was when Greensboro hosted these games 4 years ago in 2012. And we should note that there's the economic side of it, and I spoke with the Greensboro mayor today who also talked about the effect on small businesses. We're talking about hotels and caterers and folks who are earning an hourly wage, who are working in the arena, who are working around the arena doing various municipal roles. So there is the economic angle of it. I think it's also worth noting that there is this cultural angle of this as well. This is basketball, college basketball territory down here. My wife grew up here. She's told me stories about teachers rolling in televisions into classrooms so students can watch March Madness games. This is a big deal. And while the NBA moving its All-Star game and other businesses and musicians canceling concerts or canceling job expansion efforts here, those are a big deal as well. But I think this one stings a little bit differently because college basketball is so much part of the culture in North Carolina.
Well, NCAA President Mark Emmert was on CBS This Morning today. Now, it was actually the University Presidents Association of the NCAA that made this decision, and Mark explains why.
The reason the university presidents reached this conclusion last evening is because, again, this is about sports that are conducted in the context of universities, and it's trying to reflect the values of higher education in America. Inclusion, fairness, treating all of your student athletes, the coaches, their fans in a way that reflects those values at our championships, that's what matters most.
Yeah, and how are residents there reacting to that? That it's about values and inclusion, implying they don't have those values.
This is a hot-button issue. It's been a hot-button issue for 6 months. I think the reaction you get depends somewhat on where you are in the state. I mean, there are urban centers that are growing and expanding quickly here in North Carolina. There are rural areas where, for the most part, the opinion of House Bill 2 is a little bit more favorable. And clearly, as we've seen on a number of different issues and instances over the past few months, Republicans have doubled and tripled and quadrupled down on this. They're hoping to make the November election to some extent a referendum about this issue. Now, perhaps we'll get the best pulse of how the people in the state really feel about this come November 8th and 9th.
Well, it doesn't seem as if state officials are backing down. North Carolina's Republican Party spokesperson, Cammie Mueller, made a comment about, hey, maybe they'll just make the football players and cheerleaders share bathrooms. Your governor, Pat McCrory, supports the bill. He's up for re-election. And the News and Observer spoke with Lieutenant Governor Dan Forth. Here's what he had to say.
Everybody should be concerned about lost revenue, but I don't put a price tag on our women and girls of any kind. It's extortion, and it's shameful extortion. I mean, it's just unbelievable to me that these entities would think it's okay to invade the privacy or security of a woman or a girl in a shower or a locker room. I think that's a shameful act. So,
and Jeff DeBeery, holding to the notion that, you know, the flip side of the thinking of the state law, that it would negatively impact women and girls if people claiming to be transgender or of another gender enter the bathroom and violate their privacy. It doesn't sound like there's any movement on that opinion.
there is no evidence that there has been, you know, that there are instances or widespread instances of this. That is a concern that conservative lawmakers have talked about. This is a common sense public safety measure. They've said that for a long time, but there's been very little indication of there being problems with that in actuality.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, we will see when elections roll around how the residents really feel if some of these lawmakers stay in office. Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, NASA released data this week showing that August was the hottest August on record, and it tied July as the hottest month the world has ever seen since record-keeping began 136 years ago. August was the 11th record-setting month in a row. Scientists are pointing to rising levels of greenhouse gases and are raising concerns about what warming temperatures will mean for sea levels, which are already rising. Many cities and towns are assessing high-risk areas and figuring out how to limit damage. Jason Moon from Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio reports on ways some coastal communities in New Hampshire are preparing for the future.
In downtown Portsmouth, a little red brick building sits along the water near the mouth of the city's harbor. There's nothing remarkable about it. It's just a windowless brick box with a set of gray doors. But for environmental planner Peter Britz, those doors represent the front lines in the struggle to protect Portsmouth from a rising ocean.
We're looking at the outside of the pump station with doors and two steps up to the pump station, and the water has gotten to basically the bottom of the first step.
Keeping water away from those doors is important to Britz because of what's behind them, a major pump station for the city's sewage system.
When a big event like a hurricane or a flooding event happens on the coast, or sea level rise over the long term happens and water compromises this pump station, it essentially stops the ability to treat wastewater.
In other words, if the water reaches the door sill, the entire city of Portsmouth might not be able to flush the toilet. Britz is trying to identify vulnerable areas like this in the city's infrastructure and then figure out the best way to adapt them by raising a door sill, widening a culvert, or moving a storm drain. It's just one of the ways New Hampshire communities are planning for the impacts of climate change. Scientists predict the average high tide could rise by as much as 2 feet by the year 2050, and by 2100, it could be over 6 feet higher than it is today. And rather than building huge levees or erecting massive seawalls, many in New Hampshire are working on less obvious solutions.
Then use the artificial ones where we don't really have...
At nearby Cuts Cove in Portsmouth, David Burdick with the University of New Hampshire shows me what might be the most counterintuitive solution to climate readiness, tearing down an existing seawall.
This will be the first living shoreline where we're trying to get rid of a non-living shoreline.
The cove's non-living shoreline, called riprap, is basically a bank of large rocks piled along the water's edge. This hard coastal armoring has long been a hallmark of seacoast communities. Now, Burdick and a team of engineers are planning to replace a large section of the steep rock bank with a gradually sloping salt marsh, a living shoreline.
That salt marsh will grow in elevation. As it's flooded with salt water, it collects sediments and it will actually build an elevation, protecting the shoreline behind it.
The restoration of this salt marsh will provide protection for the shoreline, but it will also do something a rock wall can't, provide an important habitat for wildlife.
If we create systems where we don't have these salt marshes, like these walls, we're not going to have the fish. So if we want fish, if we want healthy habitats, we're going to have a combination of hard structures and soft structures.
While Burdick is busy creating natural habitats that protect shorelines, the city of Dover, northwest of Portsmouth, is hoping to do something similar. Only in this case, the habitat is for people and businesses.
But not for long. It's going to be gorgeous in no time.
City planner Steve Bird and engineer Rob Rosine show me a patch of overgrown land near the Cochico River in Dover. It used to be the site of a factory, then the city's wastewater treatment plant. Today, Bird and Rosine imagine it as a mixed-use development with apartments, retail spaces, and a waterfront park. They see this as an opportunity to fortify 2,000 feet of waterfront property, building, Rosine says, with the knowledge that, like it or not, the area will flood.
You plan for storms to occur. So there would be certain spaces here where we would say, all right, when this area floods, we're going to put the floods through here, and we're going to design for it so that there's minimal impact.
That new waterfront park would be built on a gentle slope, making it a new public green space and a sort of sponge for storm surge water. It would also add elevation to the property, putting the first floors of all the structures above even the highest projections for sea level rise.
These type of changes in planning are very much like you would see a change in electrical efficiency or fire safety or water quality, where it's just an incremental cost.
Incremental costs that will likely show up in ways large, small, and unexpected over the next several decades as Seacoast communities try to adapt to a new reality. For Here and Now, I'm Jason Moon in New Hampshire.
Wonder how the Electoral College will vote on December 19th. Every 4 years, we have to remind ourselves, what's the Electoral College again? Who are the 538 members? And are they just a rubber stamp of the popular vote? Or can they vote differently from states they represent? And this year, might they? Kyle Dell is a political science professor at Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina, and vice president of the board of Vote Smart, a nonprofit, nonpartisan elections research organization. He joins us by Skype. Kyle, welcome.
Thank you.
And as we've reported in other stories, it's come as something of a surprise to a lot of people this election year in particular that the founding fathers put speed bumps in the process. They were actually trying to protect against populism. So one of these, we understand, was the Electoral College. What is it?
So the Electoral College is this really interesting thing that's not a thing, right? So there's no reference to the term Electoral College in the Constitution, and barring something unusual happening, the Electoral College vote will be a very close mirror of the national popular vote.
Well, first of all, you mentioned this election season. Some people are thinking some things might happen. We'll get to that. But we understand that Alexander Hamilton explained that it would ensure that the office of president wouldn't fall to any lot of any man who is not in an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications, that it was so that there couldn't be this sort of popular uprising to have somebody go into office without a break on them, a speed break.
Right. Of course, that really crashes hard on the reality of political parties very quickly after George Washington. And it really is the case then that the Electoral College takes a back seat to political parties. I think the Electoral College system, though, still acts as somewhat of a brake on someone rising too quickly or someone without the kind of requisite testing, right? It really does push candidates, as an example, into places in this country and into different places across the country that they otherwise wouldn't go if we were just having a kind of one-day count all the votes, you know, nationwide popular vote.
Because they have to win the electoral vote across the country as well. But explain further how it works. Who gets to be an elector? Who gets to cast this vote with the Electoral College?
So the electors are going to be selected by state-level parties. So in states like Massachusetts or my state of North Carolina, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party would select what are called a slate of electors. These are generally party loyalists, people whose trust is kind of beyond reproach, because when the votes are actually cast, that slate of electors really needs to cast the right vote in order to have that reflect the popular vote that happened in that state.
Well, I want to hold you up there, because isn't it true that, in fact, the founding fathers, when they created this body, wanted the vote to be in secret to give them the right to not vote with the popular vote?
Right. And it's interesting. You had up until a few years ago, the state of Minnesota, actually, the electors were casting their ballots in secret. The challenge there, of course, is that that could promote an elector who would be considered what we would call today a faithless elector, changing his or her vote to a different candidate. So it's a process that has changed over time, and the goals of the Electoral College, I think, have changed over time But I think you still have this as kind of an intermediary body between the voters at large and then Inauguration Day.
That's Kyle Dell, political science professor at Guilford College. He's also on the board of Vote Smart. They're a nonpartisan elections research organization. We're taking a look at the Electoral College. You're listening to Here and Now. So, Kyle Dell, these days the Electoral College, it's a bit mechanical, predictable, but three presidents have been elected by the Electoral College after they lost the popular vote. Rutherford B. Hayes in 1876, Benjamin Harrison 1888, and George W. Bush, famously, in 2000.
Right, in these handful elections, as we saw just as recently as 2000, there can be this gap between the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. When the gap is in the favor of the winning candidate, it actually enhances what can appear to be a landslide election. Most of our recent presidential elections have been fairly close in the popular vote, but have been real landslides in the Electoral College. That may make new president-elects overconfident in the popularity of their agenda, but it does convey a certain level of democratic soundness, of a voice of the people, of a democratic mandate that we might not otherwise have if we have an election that's just a popular election and there's only maybe 2 or 3 percentage points different.
Now, we understand that some states did try to force the electors, you know, through state laws even, to reflect the popular vote. But that wasn't the founders' intent.
That's correct. So there was this kind of worry that electors would be faithless electors. And there are state laws that in really about a little over half of the states that actually insist that the electors cast their ballots that way. Not the intent, not the plan A of the founders, but that's where we find ourselves today.
Yeah. Well, in fact, it's the basis of an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal recently written by the conservative writers David Rivkin and Andrew Grossman. And the title is "Let the Electoral College Do Its Duty." As the Ohio Supreme Court ruled in 1948, no state can dictate to the electors how to vote. And they write that many potential Republican electors, they're usually party standard bearers, and so you can kind of know who they might be, are already publicly flirting with the idea of casting the vote for someone other than Mr. Trump because they believe his erratic outbursts have disqualified him from being president. Are you getting that sense as well that this year the Electoral College might make more of a difference?
I think it would be, it would be interesting to sit down and to actually kind of model out to see how many states really are in play, how many states still allow their electors that level of discretion. If the electors ended up exercising their discretion in that way, some would say bravely in that way, that would really be without precedent within anyone's lifetime that would be voting today.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some might ask, well, if they can't do that, why else do they exist? And we explained there was supposed to be some sort of a speed bump between the popular election and the actual, Congress authorizing the vote. But they're also there in case something happens between the election and Congress authorizing the vote.
That's right. Conceivably, the Electoral College could be a backup plan working with the political parties to say, there's something that was not that wasn't known that disqualifies a candidate, or there's something that happened to a candidate. We saw just this weekend renewed concerns about the health of Hillary Clinton. Well, we have two very old presidential candidates in comparison to the historic norm. You start to look to, okay, what's the backup system? What would the plan B be?
And it is the Electoral College. But we also have talked this election season about the election being rigged. We've heard that from Donald Trump and from supporters of Bernie Sanders. Are you hearing this more from students and this sense that, the Electoral College almost adds to the rigging, adds to the thinking that it's not what we thought it was, a popular vote?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, in some ways, as you mentioned earlier, Alexander Hamilton knew this over 200 years ago. He said about the Electoral College, if it's not perfect, at least it's excellent.
That's Kyle Dell, political science professor at Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina, also vice president of the board of directors of Vote Smart, the nonprofit nonpartisan elections research organization. Professor Kyle, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
So, are you an elector thinking of voting against the popular vote, something Hamilton would have loved? Let us know at hereandnow.org. And this Thursday, you'll be able to watch the New York Jets play the Buffalo Bills on Twitter. Okay, get all those jokes about 140 characters running around the field out of your system, because this will be the social media company's first live stream of an NFL game and the first of 10 this season, part of a new and expensive effort to reverse Twitter's fall in revenue growth. This summer, Twitter also signed streaming deals with the NHL, the NBA, and Major League Baseball, and they live streamed the conventions. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal is in New York. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Robin.
So Twitter's paying $10 million to stream the NFL games. You'll watch them on the Twitter app and also tweet about the games. But will the money Twitter makes in ad revenue make it worth that $1 million a game?
It's a very good question. And I think the short answer is, in terms of ad revenue, it's kind of hard to imagine so. You know, as you mentioned, it obtained the rights to stream 10 of the National Football League's Thursday night games, and it's going to be streaming these for free. You know, it doesn't cost the viewer, the user of Twitter, any money. And it managed to edge out Verizon, Facebook, and Amazon, who are also reportedly competing to get these games, to get this deal. But I think for Twitter, this is really about user growth. Month after month, they've been seeing a decline in users, in new users, right? Mm-hmm. And as a result, their shares are down 31% since last October. And so I think the hope is that NFL Live could breathe some new life into the platform.
Why is that, Jason? Why has Twitter struggled so much in, as you say, new users compared with other social media companies? The user number is flatlining. So is mine. Actually, it's really pitiful. But people help me out. But why is that? Why is Twitter flatlining when others are growing?
Well, that's what they've been trying to figure out. And I think it's largely about competition. There being so much competition and fierce competition from Facebook, fierce competition from Snapchat, which is so popular among young people, all of them as well trying new initiatives to get people to watch live video, seeing big revenue opportunities there. And the other thing they've been trying to work through is that for a lot of people, it's a little more difficult to use Twitter than Facebook. And it's sort of become a bastion for people who are super fans or who are, media types and people who follow, news in a big way and a more social way. You know, Facebook has, tweaked its algorithms as well to focus mostly on what people want to share from their personal lives, less from, the offerings of media companies. And, that's done quite well for them, apparently.
Right. Well, we'll see if people want to watch, a football game on their smartphone, small devices. But is this make or break for Twitter? People are talking about the company either going kaput or getting swallowed up.
It's hard to say that because, they do have such a strong following and such a loyal following. We were talking about these declines over many months. Well, that's decline in new users. They still have a very solid foundation going forward. And, they're experimenting with live. Maybe this particular thing won't work, but they are trying other things as their competitors are as well. The web video advertising market's expected to climb 28% to close to $10 billion in 2016. That's according to eMarketer. So there's money to be had as people migrate from watching video on their TV screens to watching it on the small screens in the palms of their hand.
Well, by the way, that's what I always say. Small following, but loyal. Jason Bellini, video reporter and senior producer at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
For more now on where we are nationally with self-driving cars, let's bring in our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Johanna Buya is senior transportation editor at Recode. She's with us from New York. Hi, Johanna.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well. And if this goes well in Pittsburgh, this test of these self-driving Ubers, how quickly do you think we're going to start to see self-driving Ubers, taxis, and cars catching on elsewhere?
I mean, it can go 100 different ways. A lot of it right now depends on both regulation and public opinion. In the next couple of weeks, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is expected to put out guidelines that will tell us how – or tell states how to implement and regulate self-driving technology. But even once states figure out how they want to regulate self-driving technology, which is unsurprisingly very, very complicated, we have to wait for the public to be ready for it. And that can be years down the road. And then eventually we also have to figure out how the public is going to be interacting with these self-driving cars. Are they going to be interacting with them through on-demand networks like Uber and Lyft, or are they going to be buying their own vehicles? If it's the latter, we have to take into account that at the very beginning, it's going to self-driving cars will be sold at the high end of the market. It's the most advanced technology on the market, so only a subset of people will be exposed to it. And then we have to take into account fleet turnover. It takes about 12 to 15 years for a self-driving car or a fleet to turn over completely. And so it's not until the moment that all automakers are creating self-driving cars that we'll begin to see that fleet turnover. So we'll see that is maybe another decade away, and then we'll have to wait another 12 to 15 years for the mass market to see self-driving cars.
But it sounds like what you're saying is that it's really regulatory and public opinion that is more of a burden for self-driving cars to proliferate than the technology.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've had autonomous technology for years and years. It's basically what drives our planes when they're using autopilot, not to be confused with Tesla's autopilot, which is only partially autonomous. But even Elon Musk himself has said autonomous technology is a solved problem. It's about now testing that technology in more and more complex environments. So to go from just Pittsburgh to the cities around it, or just, you know, a test track to a suburban, less crowded area, then to a crowded city like maybe New York eventually.
So do all of the companies that are working on self-driving cars, and I'm thinking of Tesla and Google and Ford, are they all using the same kind of technology, or are they working on different things?
At a very top line, yes and no. Tesla, for example, has not used laser-based radar, whereas Ford is very bullish about LiDAR and has even invested in a LiDAR company called Velodyne. And so there's still a lot of debate over how exactly – what is a necessary part of technology or the self-driving technology. And there's still debate over LiDAR. There's a debate over whether, you know, deep learning is sort of a necessity. There's a debate over communication methods. So there are very different versions of self-driving systems throughout the industry.
And when you hear the Pittsburgh mayor, as we just did, say that he thinks it's going to be decades before this technology really starts eliminating jobs, as in taxi driver jobs, do you buy that?
I do, because I don't think many people are ready to get into a self-driving Uber. And I think that it will be the biggest obstacle for companies like Uber to get the technology on the road. But the fact of the matter is Uber will benefit greatly from getting that technology on the road faster, because it takes out, you know, a huge part of their system, which is the driver. And, you know, Uber will get 80% of the fare as opposed to just 25 like it does now.
That's Johanna Buya, Senior Transportation Editor at Recode. Johanna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'd love to hear from you about whether you would get into a self-driving Uber. Let us know at our website, hereandnow.org. If self-driving cars are the future, then the future is in Pittsburgh. That's where this week Uber is testing out a fleet of self-driving cars. Joining us now is the mayor of Pittsburgh, Bill Peduto. Welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy.
So how are these tests going to work, if we want to call them tests? When are these Ubers going to be unleashed in self-driving cars across the city of Pittsburgh?
Well, Uber will be making their announcement later this week, and it will start out with several cars that will be all throughout the city. They will be expanding the program basically over the course of the next year up to 100 vehicles that will be on the streets of Pittsburgh.
And they will have people in them, these self-driving cars?
Yeah, there will be two people. There will be a person who's behind the wheel who will always have control of the vehicle. Then there will be an engineer sitting next to them who will be monitoring the sensors, the vehicle itself, and the driver.
And do you have any safety concerns about this?
Well, nothing's fail-proof, but we know that 1.3 million people are killed every year in automobile accidents, and another 5 to 8 million around the world are injured. We have to be able to start to create a safer system. And this is the beginning of a long process. And like anything that we've had tests, there's always trial and error, whether it's aviation or inoculation or autonomous vehicles. So nothing will be fail-proof, but at the same time, in the long run, we'll be able to save hundreds of thousands of lives per year.
But why did you want to do the testing in the city of Pittsburgh before any other city in America?
Well, Pittsburgh was poised for it. It wasn't really a question of what city gets to bring in Uber's autonomous vehicle worldwide center. It was which city was already ahead. So back in the 90s, and I think 94, Carnegie Mellon ran a minivan from Pittsburgh to Washington, D.C. and back without the person using the steering wheel. In 2007, Carnegie Mellon won the DARPA challenge, having an autonomous vehicle drive from Los Angeles to New York. And all the topography and the different challenges of different seasons are right here as well for a pilot program to be successful. So add on top of that a government that's willing to work like a startup, and it was a pretty good match.
So is this really about Pittsburgh's brand and enhancing this brand of Pittsburgh as a high-tech city?
Well, we've arrived. I mean, that has been well established. We have now dozens of international companies which have global innovation centers in Pittsburgh, like Google and Intel and Microsoft and Oculus, and the list goes on and on. But what this does, I think, is really brings it to more the general public. The people that still think of Pittsburgh as a rusted out old steel town and have missed the past 20 years of the transformation of the economy. So I think in some ways, yes, that is part of it. But what it also does is brings the world's best talent in robotics to Pittsburgh as well. And there's definitely a spin-off effect when that starts happening.
And what do you say to people who say that you're giving Uber a bit of a blank check here?
Well, there isn't really a blank check, and it's quite the opposite. Unlike most companies that look to set up a location that will employ over 1,000 people and invest up to $1 billion, most of the time they're looking to see what city is going to give them the most money, the most grants, the most public subsidy in order to set up operations. We haven't given Uber a nickel. And in fact, their investment in this city already is within the hundreds of millions. In a way, what they're looking for is a partner to be able to create an urban lab. And that's what Pittsburgh has been doing with both the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon University. We've done it as well with other companies within technology, and that has been transformative in having the city rise from the ashes. We went through a depression, not a recession. We lost more people out of the city than New Orleans lost after Katrina. Hmm. And there was no federal bailout or anything else. We had to brush ourselves off and do the two things that we know how to do in Pittsburgh: work hard and be innovative.
Are you worried, Mr. Mayor, that the end result of this, if this works, if this expands into cities across the country, is going to be thousands of jobs lost by taxi drivers? Because if you have the vehicle driving all on its own, you don't need that person.
So we're decades away from that. And even Uber will say that, you know, that the number of drivers that will be hired over the next several years will be increasing. This is where the world's going. I mean, it's not where this country is going, but autonomous vehicles are being tested in Gothenburg, Sweden. They're being tested in Singapore. And the fact is, if we don't seize upon this, because this is where urban mobility is moving towards. Urban mobility is becoming shared, electric, and autonomous. And over the course of the next few decades, that's really where it will go. It's not a trend. This is a paradigm shift. And if we don't do it here, it only assures that it's going to be done on another continent.
So I have one more question for you just about the regulatory system here. Are these self-driving Ubers going to be allowed to go into other cities around Pittsburgh?
Their plan right now is to stay within our borders. Their vehicles will travel 25 to 30 miles an hour on roads that are have speed limits of under 35 miles per hour. And the goal is basically set up so that it's a Pittsburgh within Pittsburgh's borders. In the future, I think that is a real possibility in the expansion into other cities. But it's like any great journey. It starts with one step at a time.
And you've gotten to take a test drive in one of these cars. What's it like?
I did. Other than seeing the wheel turn without a hand moving it, as you make a right-hand turn, it's just like riding in any other car.
I imagine it's like those player pianos that, you know.
Right.
Like, who's doing that?
Yeah. No, but it was a very, very smooth ride at a lower speed. And I've also offered to be part of the group that will be testing them in Pittsburgh.
That's Bill Peduto, the mayor of Pittsburgh, which will very soon be home to some self-driving Ubers. Mayor, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
We got some interesting numbers from the Census Bureau today. Among them, the U.S. poverty rate has fallen to 13.5% in 2015, down from 14.8% in 2014. That's the biggest decline since the mid-1990s. The median household income in the U.S. also rose last year for the first time since before the financial crisis. It was up 5.2% to $56,500. Incomes did not rise for households outside of metropolitan areas. And the number of people without health insurance fell to 29 million people, down from 33 million the previous year. In percentages, it was down to 9.1% uninsured from 10.4% the previous year. Well, so far this year, California has seen more than 5,800 wildfires consume more than 800 square miles of mountain, desert, and rural terrain. Once the flames are tamed, though, the job is far from over. People have to make sure the fire stays out. As Sharon McNary from KPCC in Los Angeles found out when she visited the pilot fire last month in San Bernardino County.
The helicopters assigned to attack the pilot fire from above have gone elsewhere. Now that the flames are out, this is the job. Mop up. It's slow work. Dirty and absolutely vital. Firefighter Nicole White swings a tool that's half axe, half hoe. It's called a Pulaski. She's pulling up rocks and roots. Every couple of swings, she takes off a glove and holds the back of her hand to the soil, testing to see if it's cool. She recently started work as a forestry technician with the U.S. Forest Service in the San Bernardino Mountains. The pilot fire was her first really big wildland fire.
Second fire, first assignment. I love it.
The fire started in the mountains, but quickly moved into a rural part of Southern California's high desert as it burned 8,100 acres over 9 days.
We were part of the initial attack.
And she got a sort of baptism, doused in fire retardant.
First thing that happened to us on the fire, we got dropped on.
Oh, no!
The aircraft that drops all the pink stuff and everything, we got some of the splatter from it.
The sleeves of her yellow fire-resistant shirt are stained with hot pink fire retardant. On this day, she kind of matches her rural surroundings, which are also tinged with pink. A nearby house, play equipment in the yard, even a collection of vintage Jaguar cars out back are solidly covered in the pink stuff dumped by a firefighting airplane. The work is slow, painstaking, and hard on the lungs because White and other mop-up firefighters are working around ash, dust, dirt, and smoke.
I mean, it's tiring. You just gotta know how to use your tools and stuff and not wear your body out doing it.
Mop-up work begins as soon as the fire is gone. The idea is to make sure that a fire, once out, stays out. It's also an important precursor to the work that comes later to stabilize the soil from erosion and reestablishing the plant life. Wet mop means putting water onto the burned edge of the fire line, digging up smoldering root balls from burned plants to douse them with water. Dry mop means mixing dirt into the ashes.
There's barbed wire over here, so if you guys come over here, just be careful. Okay.
U.S. Forest Service firefighter Mason Blair is supervising the work.
We're starting to find all the heat hot spots close to the line, and we're trying to make sure they're all extinguished so nothing can get passed across the line.
That work can last anywhere from a couple days to a few weeks, depending on the terrain and the vegetation that burned.
Yeah, there's a lot of smoke stomping, and you know, this is a big part of the job, too, is just making sure everything's secure.
That first day of the fire, Nicole White worked a 27-hour shift, cutting fire lines and assisting the so-called hot shots. Those are the firefighters who battle the flames head-on. On the third day of the fire, she'd been reassigned to a wet mop detail a few miles away from any active flames.
It's not glamorous. The TV cameras go away by the time we're in to mop up kind of work. But it's critical, but it is not without its exposure to risk.
Alex Victoria studies firefighter mishaps at the Wildland Fire Lessons Learned Center in Arizona. He says California's drought has felled many big trees whose burned root systems pose hidden dangers for mop-up crews.
Sometimes what we see is those root tunnels collapsing under the weight of firefighters, and some firefighters have gone up to their waist in these really scalding hot ash pits.
A firefighter working mop-up in Northern California was killed by a falling burned tree limb in 2008. The lessons learned from that fatality have changed the fire service standards for posting medical care closer to firefighters on mop-up duty. A couple of days in, White says she likes the work.
Just really everything. I mean, taking care of the forest, trying to make sure that we save as much as we can, helping people and protecting the things that belong to them that they worked hard for, and just the all-around job.
Given the severity of the wildfire season so far this year, White will likely get a chance to do that all-around job a few more times before winter. For Here and Now, I'm Sharon McNary.